أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد والثناء لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين، لا سيما بقية الله في العالمين، روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين. Yesterday we went over the topic of تقليد after giving an overview of the discussions that we have in fiqh. In taqlid, we mentioned that there are two very important conditions for an individual to be eligible and qualified for one to follow. And if one of these two conditions are not there, we cannot follow that individual. One of the conditions is the condition of عدالة, the marja being person who we want to refer to, who's got to be عادل, just, not openly committing sins. And the other condition has got to do with his knowledge, and that is that he must be a mujtahid. And the condition that's related to the ijtihad, that's why I categorized it as one, is the idea that the mujtahid is a'lam. And a'lam basically means that in the process of ijtihad, how this individual, the scholar, does his research into coming to the conclusion what the practical law is in a condition on a issue, he is more qualified, more knowledgeable in knowing how to do that. That is what a'lam means. We said that since we are talking about, inshallah, the fatwa of the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khamenei, in these sessions, a question that has been raised is whether he is qualified or not to, or for us to follow him. And we need to address this issue. We also pointed out that the reason why we're addressing this issue regarding this particular marja is not to say that the other marja are not qualified to be followed or anything along those lines. The other marja, alhamdulillah, there's plenty of people to speak up for them. And for the most part, or for many of them at least, there's not too much hearsay condemning them or putting them down. Others can take care of them. Since we are talking about Ayatollah Khamenei, and the circumstances here in the West especially, but worldwide I think, online especially, you see that there's a lot of questions regarding this marja and whether or not he is qualified. So we wanted to talk a little about the qualifications of Ayatollah Khamenei. First, I'll talk about the condition of ijtihad and a'lamiyyah. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939, which means that this year he turned 70. May Allah prolong his life, in July. He's born in Mashhad to a religious family. His father is an alim, a scholar. He starts his education early on. I don't want to get into the non-Hawzawi education, but he has his secular education from the regular schools in Iran, in Mashhad, where he was living. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. Ayatollah Khamenei finished all of Muqaddimat in Sutuh, and he was doing it while he was still studying his secular studies as well. Partially, the beginning of it was like that. He managed to finish all of that in 5.5 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under a prominent figure that is very well known in Najaf. He studied in Najaf, Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hadi, I believe. I'm not sure about the Muhammad, I have to check it again, but Sayyid Hadi Milani, which is originally from Mashhad, and he went back to Mashhad after finishing and after becoming a marja. And let me talk a little bit about Ayatollah Milani as well, because I don't know what picture you're getting. Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad was so pro Imam Khomeini and the revolution, at least at the beginning, that to support Imam Khomeini in the cause of the revolution, when Imam Khomeini became a marja, the Risala of Imam Khomeini, it was not allowed to be distributed because of his activities against the regime in Iran. So what Ayatollah Milani did, just to make his name, just to make an image of Imam Khomeini, he would have the Risala of Imam Khomeini in order to distribute it and put the cover of his own, just the cover says it's Ayatollah Milani's, but it's the fatwa of Imam Khomeini, to be able to distribute the fatwa of Imam Khomeini. Some of the praise that has come from Ayatollah Milani about Imam Khomeini, it was interesting. I forget who it was that was saying this, but it was a reliable source. It's in a book. There's the quotation. He says, when I went from Qom to Mashhad to visit Ayatollah Milani, I wanted to tell him what was going on in Qom. And this is like a scholar, a very well-known figure in Qom and Mashhad. He says, I told him what was going on. I mentioned Imam Khomeini's name, and I thought I heard for a second there, Salawatullah alayh. Okay, when I mentioned Imam Khomeini's name. So I thought I heard it first, and I was like, okay, I don't think so. I went on talking. The second time I mentioned Imam Khomeini's name, again he said, Salawatullah alayh. I was like, okay. And I needed to make sure that I'm hearing right here. Because usually we don't say that for someone that's not ma'soom. It's very unusual to say that term for someone that is not ma'soom. And this individual says, I asked him, did I hear right? Did you say Salawatullah alayh? He said, yes. He said, at that time they didn't even used to call him Imam Khomeini. It was either Ayatollah Khomeini or Aghaya Khomeini, whatever. So Ayatollah Milani said that the Ayatollah Khomeini that I know deserves to be called, or for it to be said regarding him, Salawatullah alayh. Anyhow, this mujtahid that according to Allama Tabatabai was the A'lam of his time, Allama Tabatabai considered Ayatollah Milani A'lam, Ayatollah Khamenei started studying under him in Mashhad. And it's important, the reason why I emphasized on the personality of Ayatollah Milani is for us to know who he has studied under. He wasn't in Najaf, but one of the prominent figures that Allama Tabatabai, who studied in Najaf, considers this individual, Ayatollah Milani, as A'lam of his time, most knowledgeable of his time. So he started his studies there, but then he went to Najaf for a while. He wanted to settle in Najaf and continue his studies in Najaf. His father disagreed with that and told him that he has to go back to Mashhad, or at least not be in Najaf. This part of the story is very similar to Ayatollah Bahjat's. I don't know if you've heard him. When he was attending Ayatollah or Allama Qadhi Tabatabai's classes in Irfan, his father told him not to attend because his father was told that this guy, Allama Qadhi Tabatabai, is a Sufi and he's a deviant teacher, this and that. So his father banned him, and because of that he stopped going. So Ayatollah Khamenei, he listened to his father and he went back. He didn't go to study in Najaf, but he went to Qom. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under the teachers their name follows: Ayatollah Burujerdi, which was the Marja'ul Aam at that time, someone that had studied in Najaf, a very prominent figure that had moved to Qom. The teacher of many of the current Maraja in Qom was Ayatollah Burujerdi. Of course, Imam Khomeini did not study much under him. Even when he did, he didn't. That wasn't his real teacher, because he had already finished his studies under Ayatollah Hari. Anyhow, Ayatollah Burujerdi was one of his teachers. Imam Khomeini, he studied under Imam Khomeini as well. The son of Ayatollah Hari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Hari, which was one of the top figures in Qom, a friend of Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini has studied under him as well, and also under Allama Tabatabai. He's studied a little while. How long, I don't know the exact details of that. But for 7 years he was in Qom and he studied under these individuals. Then he went to back to Mashhad. For 4 years he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. So, after his sutuh, he has studied 11 years under teachers, Bahth al-Kharij. Okay. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahth al-Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. They testified, these are scholars, that in 1337 he was a mujtahid, not now." This is, I think, 5 years, yes, 5 years before the movement of Imam Khomeini started. This is important. Some people say, oh, he's always been in politics, and yes, he's been active, but 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And this is, it's not unusual for someone, and that time he was 19, apparently, if you do the calculations. It's not unusual. Shaheed Assad was a mujtahid before he was baligh, actually, according to the testimony of Ayatollah Khui. If I remember correctly, the date of that goes back to before Shaheed Assad was even baligh, or maybe a little after it, but the talk about his ijtihad is about before he was even baligh. So the ijtihad that he has is testified by scholars to be 5 years before the movement of Imam Khomeini began. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. After that, apparently he gets involved more in his political and social activities. And at that point, I believe he would be, like, after 11 years, the teachers that are more familiar with Bahth al-Kharij and have given advice on how much to attend Bahth al-Kharij and where the benefits are going to be, they say within 2 or 3 years you should be gaining the ijtihad, if it takes that long. And afterwards, for a little while, for a few years, you need to go to see what you can benefit from the teachers. After that, it's your own work. So after 11 years of attending Bahth al-Kharij, Ayatollah Khamenei does not attend Bahth al-Kharij any longer, at least on a continuous basis. And he does his own research, he does his own studies, and he's actively involved in the revolution. He holds classes of tafsir in Tehran and in other cities of Iran, in Mashhad. And he gets involved with, you know, he's exiled and a lot of things happen. He's sometimes imprisoned during the previous regime. The question that comes up is that, okay, if even if the individual was mujtahid, but all these years of staying away from studies. First of all, Ayatollah Khamenei has never stayed away from studies. This is this testimony comes from, I think, one of, I think it was either Ayatollah Mishkini, I think it was Ayatollah Mishkini or Ayatollah Jannati, one of these figures. When Ayatollah Khamenei was a president in the beginning of, after the revolution succeeded, a few years after that, he was president for two terms. He served two terms before he became the supreme leader. During that time, Ayatollah Mishkini, I think it is, said that, I saw one of the sons of Ayatollah Khamenei and asked him, what are you studying? He said, Shara'i', one of the books of fiqh. He said, who's teaching you? He said, my father is teaching me. And Ayatollah Mishkini was amazed. He said, for an individual with all these responsibilities to be able to manage to fit that in the schedule and teach that class, it is a very great accomplishment. He never stopped his studies. He has stated this himself too, that I always try to keep an hour or two in my schedule open for studies. You can't keep away from them. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. Currently you can find some of his the material that he has taught on his site, of course, in the Farsi language. I'm sure it exists. In Arabic, I don't know, I don't think so. In English, definitely it does not exist. But in Farsi, it's there. And of course, that's not all of what he has taught. That's only part of it. I don't know why they haven't updated that. How can someone focus on their studies and do the work, all these other activities as well? There's a few points to keep in mind. First of all, usually the maraja that we are following, the fatawa that we have from them, are not their fatawa when they are 60 years old. The fatawa that you have from them are usually from earlier on in their studies. Maybe around when they're like 20-something, 30-something, the first few years after their ijtihad, they do the ijtihad and the taharat and salat and all those things, which Ayatollah Khamenei has his own hashiya, his commentary on one of the fiqh books, most probably Urwa. That's what was common to have the commentary on. In other words, the side notes where the fatawa differ. He has had that, and he's had his own views in usul, in rijal, that many scholars are not very strong in. I can, if it would have been appropriate, I would have named some scholars that are not very strong in rijal, but Ayatollah Khamenei particularly is very strong in rijal. He's done that very well. In usul, he's very strong. In fiqh, the understanding is very strong. And to compare people by saying that this person has spent this many years in the Hawza, the other person has spent less years in the Hawza, that's not a good comparison. Because if you go to Qum and go to Faydiyah, the main school there, the traditional, the old school, towards the time of Maghrib, you'll start seeing some pretty old men sitting there that they've spent all their life in the Hawza, but they haven't gained anything. And in Bahthul Kharij, if you attend, there's many people that are attending, but I can testify and be responsible for it on the Day of Judgment that the majority of people are not benefiting from the teacher the way they should have benefited. It's not about the number of years, it's about the talent of the individual, how talented he is. And also about the amount of work that he puts while he's studying and continuing that, and whether he teaches or not, which Ayatollah Khamenei has taught at least, at the very least, once the main subjects in Sutuh as well, before he was considered a marja and people started following him, which was then when he started the Bahthul Kharij. So, no doubt, the ijtihad... Oh, one last point regarding the ijtihad for those, because unfortunately, as some of the scholars were saying, this is from Ayatollah Misbah, he said, when we read history, we read certain things that we don't, it doesn't make sense to us. Like, how did this happen? Then when you experience it, you start realizing, oh my God, you know, this is actually happening. One of the things we read in history, which is difficult to understand, is that they say when they assassinated Amir al-Mu'mineen in the masjid, when the news got to Sham, they said, oh, Ali prayed? Ali used to pray? That's how much propaganda was against that individual, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayh, that people thought he's not even Muslim, he's not even praying. Unfortunately, these days, there's so much accusations and so much false information that forget about a'lamiyya, people are questioning ijtihad and things like that, and it's very, you know, you start to feel like how it was back in those days when Amir al-Mu'mineen was assassinated like that. Regarding ijtihad, we have one of the strongest figure in our Shia or the history of our Shia jurisprudence and fiqh, testifying to the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei for sure. That individual, all of what I said, put that aside, the individual that I'm mentioning is an individual who has his usul, has been printed, four or five different students have written his usul. He has written an usul himself, which is rare in the recent history for a faqih and an usuli to write his own usul, okay, and not his students just write down what he has said in class. His fiqh is a very strong fiqh, and he has ijtihad from numerous scholars, and that individual is the late Imam Ruhullah al-Khumayni, rahmatullah alayh. He has testified to the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei when he has said that in a few instances where he was asked what's going to happen after you, who is going to rule, he has said Ayatollah Khamenei is qualified to rule. The main qualification that Imam Khomeini had in mind for ruling, other than the other, you know, the aspects of the personality and things, is the concept of ijtihad. At the very least, that Imam Khomeini has testified in this statement, and he has said a few times, he has mentioned this a few times to different individuals. So the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei is no doubt established, comparing him to the scholars that are considered of those who may be a'lam. I could testify by comparing the works of Ayatollah Khamenei, which, as I said, they're available and one can see them for those who are they know fiqh and usul and they can judge. If you compare that to some of the others that are, whether in Qum or Najaf, that have Bahthul Kharij and they're discussing those same issues, if you look at the understanding of usul in those words, Rijal that is involved, their understanding of hadith, the ahadith that are brought, how they are put together and all of that, it is definitely, I don't want to make a judgment here and say who is a'lam, or I'm just trying to clarify the doubts. It is most definitely comparable, and at the very least, above many of the others, which I won't mention names, clearly above many of the others that are considered a'lam, and they have many followers, and nobody is questioning their ijtihad or a'lamiyyah. This is the aspect of ijtihad and the knowledge, the a'lamiyya of Ayatollah Khamenei. The aspect of idala is the like of me to talk about the idala of Ayatollah Khamenei is something that is not justice. Okay, if I went to talk about the idala, to tell you that he is adil, somebody would have to establish my idala if I want to talk about Ayatollah Khamenei. But this individual is undoubtedly one of the most just, one of the most pure scholars that we have, that has full control of his nafs. Okay, not just a normal idala, not just a normal idala. It is far beyond just a regular idala of not committing sins. We don't hear too much of the personal life of Ayatollah Khamenei and how he lives his life right now. Okay. Background about his childhood: he was raised in a poor family. They had a very small house with one room in like other than the main hall of the room, there's only one room there in a dark basement. They didn't have anything else. 70 square meters is the house. And later on it was expanded a bit. They had three rooms with the family that his father had. They only had three rooms. He grew up and he had his own family. He has some children. I have seen his sons personally in Qum. They walk around. Comparing, just before anything else, if you just compare the children of Ayatollah Khamenei compared to others, I don't want to mention names again. First, let's just compare the amount of wealth and power that is easily accessible by Ayatollah Khamenei and his family members. The wealth that Iran has, okay, all of the oil fields, that's all under the government. All of the gas, that's all under the government. The wealth that Iran has, it's all to a great extent, okay, whatever is governmental, which there's a lot there, is easily accessible by Ayatollah Khamenei and his children and his whole family. If anyone wanted to be corrupt, if they wanted to access any of that, like the children of some others, which you hear on the news these days, and I don't want to mention names, they can easily have access to all of that and get involved in all kinds of corruption. But when you look at these, the children, before I even get to Ayatollah Khamenei, to see what type of a figure their father is, that all of them are the same. When they wanted to go, I know the father-in-law of one of the sons, at least, of Ayatollah Khamenei. It's an individual called Ayatollah Khushfaqt. One of the students of Allama Tabatabai and Irfan. When they wanted to go and find or introduce their son to ask for the hand of the daughter of this particular scholar, that wasn't the first one they went to. When they would go to people and ask, they wouldn't say who this individual is. They would go on behalf of them and say, there's a talaba, not Ayatollah Khamenei himself, some people on his, there's a talaba that wants to come, a talaba, a house student, a regular house student that wants to come and ask for your daughter's hand. Are we allowed to come and speak? A regular house student. A lot of people rejected because of that. They didn't know it was Ayatollah Khamenei's son. If they would know, they would definitely say, please, you know, more than welcome. They just said, a regular talaba, are we? Said, no. But Ayatollah Khushfaqt said, yes, you're welcome, you can come, and they came. And this is the type of approach that they have. When you see them on the streets in Qum, okay, there's no bodyguard or any fancy car or anything like that. They're just walking on the streets. You can, a lot of people don't know who they are, but those who do know, like myself, you know who they are. This is how they live their lives. One of my teachers has visited the house of one of Ayatollah Khamenei's sons, and it's, you know, very, very, very regular, if not below standard, living standards in Iran, that type of a life that they have. Below standards is definitely below the normal standard, but as a talaba, it's around, you know, the standard of how a house of students lives their life, or his life. That's how they live. Those who've had contact with Ayatollah Khamenei himself in his house, this is, I think, said by Ayya Haddad Adil or Ayy Velayati, which I've personally seen that individual, Haddad Adil. And he's a very honest and sincere and simple person, and simple in the sense that, you know, it's easy to talk to. He doesn't, like, hold himself up high, although he was the parliament speaker at one point. Anyhow, he says that, either him or Ayy Velayati, they said that when Ayatollah Khamenei moved to go to the house where he's staying at right now, they wanted to move, obviously, the equipment, whatever he had in his home. He said, when we went to the new house, Ayatollah Khamenei asked, we moved everything. We thought everything was finished. We went to the house and Ayatollah Khamenei said, what happened to my stove? Why didn't you bring my stove? And he said, we didn't see any stove. He started describing what it looked like. And he said, when he described it, I remember that there was a piece of junk that we thought it's to throw away, useless material that is not really usable for any purpose, we thought that, you know, just put it aside to throw it away. And Ayatollah Khamenei was saying, that is my stove. Those who've gone over his house to for official sessions to talk about government issues, about what's going on in the society, a number of them have had this experience that when they had the meeting with him, the time of food, lunch, dinner, whatever it was, came, and the individual is obviously, because he's there on a governmental affair, he's talking about things that are related to issues regarding the country. They would provide and prepare some food, a decent food, not like too low in standards, nothing special either, just decent food, some little bit of chicken and rice. But there would be only enough for two people. Ayatollah Khamenei's son would come in, okay, or he would be there. Sometimes he would even be there, like during that session, he would be there. When the time for food would come, Ayatollah Khamenei would tell him, you know, you have to go back in the house and eat from the food in the house, which is not the same as the food that is over there, prepared over there. Those who visited the house have had some experiences which are not really believable. What I'm saying, many people are going to probably say, oh, this is, you know, this is fairy tales. You're talking about, I mean, you know, whoever wants to accept it, they can accept it. They don't want to accept it, that's fine. But this is a reality. Those who visited and the friends of the sons of Ayatollah Khamenei that have gone there, what they've gotten for food wasn't really something that got rid of their hunger and filled them up. Yogurt and bread and things like that. Anyhow, so he would tell the son, not like, oh, he's here to order some more food, bring some food for him too, there's three of us. No, you're not here for government issues, you don't have to be here, so for the food you have to leave, you have to go home and have the food at home. When you look at the decisions that this man has made throughout the years that he's been the supreme leader, and even before then as the president, without a shadow of a doubt, if this man wanted to be or have the slightest bit of corruption in him, the slightest bit of hawa'un nafs, okay, the desires to stop him from making the right decisions, many of the decisions that have caused him to be targeted by so many individuals and his reputation be destroyed, he wouldn't have made those decisions. By just being in the presence of this man and praying behind him, listening to him, following. Unfortunately, maybe many of you don't speak Farsi or don't understand Farsi. But if you follow even the translation, I think, and look at the way he has guided this country in the Islamic direction throughout these years, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, okay, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to see the truth and to accept the truth and to guide us in the cases where there's fitna and there's our views could easily be blurred by propaganda, that he shows us what the truth is, inshallah, and that we are able and manage to accept that, inshallah. What is that?
Can the questions be not related to?
Yeah.
Okay. The question I had was with regards to agreements that Muslims will make with amongst themselves or with others. Agreements of various nature. If they agree upon a project or something, and they working together on it, and they agree to certain responsibilities. Most of the times they might be unwritten verbal agreements. I guess one question comes to mind is, what restrictions, or how seriously should one take those agreements? From the point of view of fiqh or Islamic laws, and also from the point of view of just ethics in general, or I don't know if ikhlaq plays a part in it or not, and how seriously should one take those agreements, and if they violate them, you of course you run the risk of losing your reputation, but how, what are the Islamic repercussions that one faces?
Agreement, law in general, okay, something that you got to be very specific on the words that are used. Agreement could be one of two things. It's either a contract, okay, whether verbal or written, or it's just an agreement. Agreement meaning that I say I'll do this. I'm just promising that I'll do something. Okay, it could be one of these two. If it's just a promise, that I promise that I'm going to do such and such, okay. And you promise that you're going to do something else, okay. But it's not a contract. It doesn't fit in any form of a contract, okay. The contracts that we have in Islam. That is called, in fiqh, we call that wa'd, okay, to promise. Many of the fuqaha say to break a promise, it is makruh. In terms of ethics and akhlaq, it's not good. In fiqh, we call that makruh. According to Atlas Sistani, it's an ihtiyat wajib that you don't break a promise. So that's for a promise. But regarding a transaction or a contract, in Islam, the question is, do written contracts, or are they valid? The question is not the other way around. That nowadays, we usually consider a written contract valid, and we ask about whether a verbal contract is valid or not. In Islam, it's usually the other way around. There's no doubt that a verbal contract is going to count. As soon as you make a verbal contract, then that's binding, whether it's written or not. The question that has come up in fiqh is that if we don't have a verbal agreement as a contract, and we write the contract only, like we're chatting online, okay, or I just send an email, you send me back an email, is that going to count as a contract or not? Okay. Some say yes, some say no. So, in your question, if there's a verbal contract, then no doubt it counts. It's got to be abided by. Thank you very much. But if it's a contract.
So how do you differentiate between, the contract from a promise that you have to set certain boundaries, or how do you differentiate between what you initially said was a promise and a contract?
A promise...
They were both verbal.
Yeah, a promise, just I promise that, you know, I'll do this. You're asking me to do something for you, and I say, okay, I'll do it. Okay, I promise that I'll do it. And you're expecting me to do it, and then I don't do it, you know, that's breaking a promise. But a contract is, I'll do this in return for something else. Okay, will you do that? Yeah, you know, I'll do it only if you do something else as a contract. Not just, you know, that could sound like a promise too, depending on what it is. The contracts that we have, there's a list of contracts like buying and selling or renting or like in terms of any of these, like renting. Renting means, like, for example, you do something for me, that's renting you out. Okay, that you, I pay for you doing this job for me. What do I pay for that? How do I pay? I may do something for you, like you design this site for me, and that's your profession, and I'll take care of, I don't know, I have a body shop, I'll fix your car up. Okay, you make me a site. This wouldn't be a promise, it would be a contract. Okay, that I do this in return for that.
Exchange of goods.
Exchange of goods, yes. This is one contract. The other contracts, like Aariyah, to take, that we had yesterday, to take like my car, okay, for free. I give them, of course, that contract is not binding on me, so I can take it back anytime I wish. The ones that are binding, like renting, if it's verbal, I rent my place out, my car out. As soon as the contract is done, then that person has got the right to the car. You know, I can't take it back now that I've said it.
So the promise, if you break it, is maqbool.
Yeah, for the majority of scholars.
Sure. And for breaking contracts, is that haram?
Yes. أَوْفُوا بِالْعُقُودِ. The Holy Quran says, any contract you make, you have to abide by it, stick to it.
Thank you.
No problem. Yes? Alaykum as-salam.
My question is in regards to, you had mentioned with Ayatollah, is it Sayyid Milani?
Yes.
Okay. That he had supported Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
And then he had changed his position, I guess.
Yes.
And I guess there's been, there's been quite a few scholars that did that. They supported him initially and then they stopped. Was there any one condition that made them switch their support for him, or were there different ideas, or was it propaganda? What was it, that made that happen?
I don't know the full story of Sayyid Milani's switch and what happened with him. Ayatollah Khamenei has said that it's because of an individual that was in contact with Sayyid Milani, but I don't have any further explanation who that individual is, what they've said, or what happened there. I don't know. But those who were initially with Imam Khomeini, of course, Sayyid Milani, apparently he kind of broke off before the revolution succeeded. It wasn't one of those that was after the revolution. And those who broke off after the revolution, there's a lot of different reasons why each of them would. Ayatollah Khamenei, yeah.
But then at the beginning you said that he wasn't ma'soom.
Yes.
How do those go together? Because if you're not corrupt, then you're perfect. If you're perfect, are you ma'soom?
It's a good question. The question is about isma. What we said, does that not mean isma? Is he ma'soom? Before I answer the question in regards to Ayatollah Khamenei, I need to clarify something regarding isma and considering someone infallible, okay, which is not a very good equivalent, but that's what they use. They call isma infallibility. For a person to be ma'soom, they don't have to be an imam. Okay, don't take this, I'm not finished with the explanation, don't take this as saying that I'm claiming Ayatollah Khamenei is ma'soom, no. Let's just, first, it's an explanation regarding isma itself. This is what the scholars have, many of them have clearly stated. Others haven't said anything against, and the sources that we have and reason tells us that this is completely reasonable. When we say a ma'soom, the imams are ma'soom, the Holy Prophet is ma'soom, Hazrat Fatima is ma'soom, that isma is different than the type of isma that we talk about when we talk about others, if we talk about it. The isma of a ma'soom is two aspects. One, it deals with the knowledge of the ma'soom. They never even make a mistake in their knowledge. Okay, what they know is going to be what is right. Okay, whereas for anyone that is not ma'soom, they don't have that. They could make mistakes. Their research in fiqh, a lot of these people are very good people. They have difference of opinion when it comes to fiqh and other issues of Islamic scholarship. Well, one of them is going to be right, not all of them. So we could make a mistake, a person that is not one of the imams or a prophet, they can make mistakes in their knowledge, and this is a fact. But a ma'soom, that is one of the imams or a prophet, their knowledge is going to be, they're going to be ma'soom in their knowledge. And especially, I'm talking about the 14 ma'soom that we have. About the previous prophets, I won't speak up too much. And regarding the isma that deals with their practice, the imam is ma'soom from the beginning all the way to the end. Okay, we know for a fact they can never, not they can't in a sense, they will never make or commit a sin. They have never, they will never. We have a rational reasoning for that. But for someone that is not one of the imams, if they reach a stage where they're not committing any sins, which one can reach that stage, they have a practical ismah. They're not committing any sins. Okay, in practice, they have reached that ismah. And there are ahadith that tell us that if we reach that stage where we're not committing any sins and we continue with that, there's a ruhul iman that becomes strong in us and it keeps us from, it helps us out. It becomes much more difficult for us to commit sins. The same way that the Ahlul Bayt have ruhul qudus, which is beyond that. It's the type of ismah that they have, and the ismah that a non-imam can have is at a lower level. But in practice, a non-imam can actually reach a stage where they don't commit any sins. Not just that they don't commit any open sins, but they don't commit any sins at all. Regarding Ayatollah Khamenei, what we know for sure is that one of the qualifications of not just a waliul faqih, but a marja, is that they have to be adil. If they're not adil, then they don't have the qualification to be a marja any longer. Okay. There's a group of 80-something or 70-something people, they're keeping an eye over Ayatollah Khamenei, the moves that he's made, the decisions that he's made. They're in contact with him. They see him almost on a daily or weekly basis. And they testify, all of them are scholars, they're all mujtahids themselves. They're all testifying that this individual is adil, he is not committing any sins. This is what, on the apparent level, we can conclude, that there's no sins being committed. But what I can say is, it is far beyond that, okay, just not committing sins openly. As I said, to understand what I'm saying, I think we would have to understand the human nature. If there is one little spot of corruption in one, when there's a lot of tests and more difficult tests, that little bit of corruption in one's soul is going to start showing itself. Okay, it's going to start expanding because that's how this life is. Okay, and shaitan comes to us from all different angles to try to get us at our weak spot. If there's that weak spot, which comes about because of sins, committing haram, if that exists, okay, then there's room for more corruption and it expands until one becomes completely corrupt. But throughout these years, not only is there not a single instance where he's made the wrong decision knowingly, intent, maybe in knowledge, maybe he made a mistake, and you know, God knows. As far as I know too, I would agree with every single thing that he has done, because I've followed the news and I see the outcome of what he has said and what he has done. I know the private ones that are not even broadcasted. There's a lot of lives, there's a lot of private sessions that none of you have heard of, okay, in which he, some of these, you know, government individuals that we see on TV, Ayatollah Khamenei is, you know, speaking of their, they seem to be okay, there's nothing wrong being said in those private sessions. He bashes them pretty harshly and tells them, you know, why are you doing this? This is wrong, and things like that. So, maybe there would be like a lack of information where a decision is made, but all the cases where there's two choices to make, you either go with this side or the other, and it's very easy to save his image and to give in to the pressure that is put on him if he was weak inside, if that weakness that is the result of sin, it would be very easy for him to make the wrong decision and choose to speak words that would satisfy those who are pressuring him. But it's never happened, inshallah, it will never happen. I can say, I personally believe that the idala is far beyond that. To state that it's at the level of a non-imam's isma, that's something that, you know, it's not easy to make, but it's, if not there, it's very close to that, my personal view.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.